U.S. equities closed near all-time record highs, reversing course on dovish talk from the FOMC. Welcome, everyone. Your host, Chris Walczyk, back here again with you for another show. Happy holidays. Merry Christmas to everyone and happy Hanukkah. We're so glad that you've spent another year with us here at Goldseek. Next year marks our one decade anniversary. We've got top interviews with your favorite industry professionals, as well as the market headline. First up, Peter Schiff and I decipher the Fed speak in real time on Wednesday. You can listen to Peter Schiff's comments on the market. Dovish talk from the Fed suggests the rate hike will be postponed for the time being. Peter Schiff is bracing for increased global market volatility now that the Fed has pulled the plug on QE operations. Plus, the Fed's balance sheet is approaching $5 trillion. Yeah, a little walking around money there, which makes hyperinflation a virtual lock. And all that's necessary to corner the COMEX precious metals market is just the fraction of one of the Dow's 30 components. And apparently, there's a $600 gold premium in Asia for large tonnage purchases, indicating short supply around the world. Then Fabian Calvo joins the show. He says very little has changed since the last credit crisis. In fact, our financial institutions are making matters even worse by giving mortgages and loans to almost anyone, setting the stage for another credit crisis. And the national debt has topped $230 million. That's about 15 times everything produced in the nation by every company and individual. Eventually, the debt will capsize the U.S. dollar, making precious metals once again the investment du jour. And Robert Ian wraps up the show with his latest editorial. Goldseek.com radio begins now with the market weather recap. Cloudy skies appeared over the precious metals market this week as investors took some time off to digest the latest FOMC report. At Friday's closing bell in the New York COMEX exchange, gold dropped $26, off about 2%, finishing at $1,194 with an earshot of $1,200 an ounce. Silver was off a dollar, 6%, ending at $1,603, and the XAU gold and silver's index, though, bucked the trend, adding about 1%, up 0.68 points, ending just shy of 70. Palladium added 1270, closing near 814, while platinum lost 31, finishing at 1197 an ounce. West Texas Intermediate crude was off a dollar, 2% for the week, ending at 56.52. And the top story driving the precious metals markets this week. On Wednesday, the FOMC released its meeting statement indicating new guidance on the benchmark lending rate. Fed governors plan to hold rates close to zero for a considerable time, noting they plan to be patient at the beginning. The report was viewed as a positive by gold investors. The president of Russia offered positive words on Thursday that the Russian ruble would stabilize and the economic troubles would pass. That's including the recent intervention on the part of the Russian Central Bank. The world's fifth gold holder increased its stockpile for the eighth month and implemented an emergency interest rate increase this week. On a weekly basis, the ruble does look solid, though. Signs of a nadir starting to show up. Russia increased its stockpile to 38 million ounces, according to data from the International Monetary Fund. The country has tripled its gold reserves since 2005 and now holds about 1,200 tons, which, interestingly, is the exact amount of gold during the reign of the last monarch, the last of the Romanov czars. Bottom line on the precious metals. The precious metals were subdued, I think, a bit by the soaring U.S. dollar, which did break out to multi-year highs this week, mostly due to global currency woes. However, the XAU is finally showing relative strength. This is a positive sign, as well as the CRB Commodities Index. For the time being, caution, though, I think is still advisable. Moving on to the Wall Street Report, visibility virtually unlimited over the New York Stock Exchange this week. Investors snapped up bargain shares in the wake of dovish Fed speak. The Dow added 522 points, up 3%, finishing at 17804, once again within striking distance of that 18,000 level. The S&P 500 picked up 68 points, 3.4%, finishing at 2070, while the Nasdaq added 111 points, 2.4%, at 47.65. The top story impacting the equities markets this week, investors cheered the new guidance in the FOMC statement, which indicates low lending rates are here to stay. Lower rates make stocks more favorable than fixed income assets. Investors prefer to chase capital gains over low interest rates. Plus, increased lending tends to favor corporate expansion and new projects, which encourages further hiring, new jobs, and lower unemployment, bringing about a greater chance for corporate profits and share prices. One interesting IPO this week, shares of Juno Therapeutics surged $11, nearly 50%, to $35 in its opening debut. Solid IPO markets tend to coincide with bull market rallies, and this is a positive indication for the year to come that the six-year rally may continue into the new year. Bottom line on Wall Street. Well, our trusty 7 indicator index remains in the fearful zone despite one of the most powerful rallies of the year. The metric helped me predict last week's rally that came to pass this week, so I expect further buying next week as the nervous Nellies stay on the sideline. Coming up after the break, more GoldSeek.com radio with Peter Schiff and Fabian Calvo. We'd like for you to stay with us right here at GoldSeek. Here is your mining quiz for the day, compliments of GoldSeek. Which company has the largest undeveloped gold reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold. Now, which company has the largest undeveloped copper reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold again. Seabridge has more gold reserves than Kinross, Yamana, and Agnico Eagle. Last year alone, Seabridge added 515 million tons of new inferred resources containing nearly 6 million ounces of gold and more than 6 billion pounds of copper at their giant KSM project in British Columbia, Canada. Now they are drilling at KSM again with multiple rigs in a 25,000-meter program. Find out more by visiting www.seabridgegold.net. Traded on the NYSE, symbol SA, and the TSX, symbol SEA.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
Well, Peter Schiff, chairman of Schiff Gold, located at schiffgold.com, author of several bestsellers. Welcome back to the show, Peter Schiff.
Thanks for having me back on.
Let's begin today with the crude oil meltdown. You know, the impact it's had on the global economy already starting to show signs in the last couple of months or so. West Texas Intermediate crude has lost nearly 50%, primarily on dollar strength and economic weakness in China and the EU. Something similar occurred in 2008. It coincided with the equities meltdown. Do you see anything similar on the horizon?
Well, you know, I think a lot of markets have been influenced by cheap money, the Federal Reserve. Oil prices are one of them. I mean, oil prices went up to $150 a barrel in 2008 because of the easy money policies that fueled the housing bubble. And they went up about to maybe $115 a barrel after they collapsed down to $32 a barrel, right, in 2008. And I think a lot of the price increases is due to inflation. It's due to central banks creating money. Well, the markets are preparing for the Fed to stop creating money. In fact, the Federal Reserve has been bluffing that not only will it end QE, but it will raise interest rates and shrink its balance sheet, which is like destroying money, taking money out of circulation, shrinking the money supply. That's what the Fed has been pretending it can do. And I think that has effects as people start to price that in. And it just so happens that maybe the first market to feel the pain is the oil market. But if the Federal Reserve continues on this pretense, it'll be a lot of markets, like the stock markets and the real estate markets. And in fact, the U.S. economy will be back in recession if the Fed removes all the monetary props, which is why I don't believe that they're going to do it. I mean, they just came out today with a statement, and it's all a bunch of nonsense because they know they have no intention of ever raising rates.
But according to the Federal Reserve Bank of Cleveland, as of this month, December 2014, their balance sheet has never gone down. In fact, it's approaching $4.5 trillion. That's on track for $5 trillion. Now, here's the question. How can the dollar remain so strong when the currency is debased to such a degree? Is it merely the least toxic currency on the block?
Well, it's because, A, yes, other central banks are debasing their currencies, too. but people have confidence that the actions of the Fed will be reversed. Janet Yellen has promised to reduce the balance sheet down below a trillion by the end of the decade. Now, of course, nobody has bothered to consider that that's not even possible, that there's no way that the Fed could do that because there's no one who would buy those bonds. The Fed can't get rid of $3.5 trillion worth of treasuries and mortgages. There's no buyers. But people just don't bother to connect the dots. But I think when they do, look today, the Fed came out when they tweaked this statement, the considerable period. So they came out and they said, okay, we'll be patient. But then they said, but patient means the exact same thing as considerable period. Well, then what's the point of changing the words? I mean, if you're going to go out and say that the meaning hasn't changed, then why change the words? I mean, that's all they can do. But the one thing they can't do is actually raise rates. So they're just trying to, put some kind of spin on it. They're trying to pretend that they're going to do it without actually doing it.
Jim Rickards is calling for $3,000 gold, $100 silver. Don't expect these numbers overnight. He says the next bull market in precious metals, though, could leave many investors flat-footed, scratching their heads, wondering what's going on, that conditions could shift overnight. It's so abrupt, many people miss the opportunity altogether.
I would kind of agree that I think when this market really turns, it's going to do it, with a vengeance. It's going to be in a way that if you're not already in the market, you're not getting in. And if you're short, you're just going to be decimated. I mean, I could see the market, the gold market, moving up over $100 in a single day, maybe $200 or $300. I mean, I think that could happen. Because I think when enough people come to the correct conclusion, maybe the Fed announces QE3 or tips its hat that it's losing its confidence in the recovery and it is actually contemplating more quantitative easing. Nobody expects that. Everybody is positioned for the opposite of that, and I think when you get a scramble back into gold, particularly from the shorts who want to cover and new longs who want to enter, there is no supply to meet that demand, and the price would have to skyrocket.
Most people, when they hear of market manipulation, in the past it conjured up images of traders on the wrong side of the market, trying to talk the market back in line with their expectations. But more recently, the number of well-documented cases of manipulation, I think these scandals are just piling up. Look, we've got the LIBOR rate-fixing scandal. More recently, there's been currency rigging allegations. These are enormous markets. To give some perspective, the Forex trades over $3 trillion a day. That makes the stock and the bond markets look small in comparison. And silver and gold, drops in the bucket. Do you take any comfort in the fact that these markets are being downward manipulated, gold and silver? And what could that mean going forward?
Well, again, I don't know that it's necessarily manipulation, but it's the major players all acting in unison based on the same themes and the same misconceptions. I mean, think about all the people that piled into dot-com stocks in the 1990s. I mean, the stocks weren't being manipulated, but the prices were rising based on the decisions that people were making at that time. And it was only, the ultimate, fundamentals reasserting themselves as, companies started losing money and defaulting on their obligations. When new companies couldn't come to market because that the bubble burst. And, the same thing happened in housing and in the mortgage market. It wasn't a conspiracy or a manipulation. It was just a bunch of decisions made by a lot of people with a lot of borrowed money. And so I think the same people that made the decisions to buy dot-coms and to buy mortgages, subprime mortgages, are shorting gold. I mean, they're convinced that that's the thing to do, just like they were convinced that the dot-coms were the things to do. But once again, they're going to be spectacularly wrong, and I think the losses that they're going to suffer are going to be substantial.
According to one media source, it would take less than $2 billion to corner the COMEX, just a fraction of the cost of even one Dow Jones component. Do you see a time where the major precious metals exchanges have difficulty delivering any precious metal?
Oh, yeah. I mean, certainly. And that's what, you think about the things that if Putin was really thinking and he's concerned about the situation with the ruble, they've got enormous foreign reserves. If they simply use some of those foreign reserves to buy gold and silver futures, or maybe gold futures because it's easier for delivery, if they just went in there and bought a bunch of gold futures and then asked for delivery, that would be enough to skyrocket the price of gold, which then they would own even more gold. But I think the collapse of the dollar that would result from the skyrocketing price of gold would also be bullish for the ruble.
I'd like to talk about a major dislocation that's being reported by Merton Armstrong. According to some of his sources, any major buyer, any big player in the precious metals market is finding delivery virtually impossible for anything less than $600 over spot. Like, here's an example. Let's say the price of gold around $1,100, $1,200. Anything in tonnage could require $1,700, $1,800 or more, and the only place they can find sellers are in Asia. Can you translate this into everyday trader and investor lingo?
It means if you're looking for significant quantities of gold, they're just not to be had. That, you know, we're not experiencing that right now on the retail level because we don't have clients that are buying gold by the ton. You know, we're selling it by the ounce. And in that respect, we're not having a problem, at ship gold for people who want to buy, you know, 5-10 ounces of gold. But you know, if you have major players who are looking to move significant amounts of fiat into gold and they're having a problem locating the physical, that really shows you how tight the supply is. And, you know, what I would suggest some of those entities do, rather than paying such a big premium to the spot price, just go buy some futures contracts and take delivery because it's a lot cheaper there. And that's assuming, of course, the counterparty is able to affect delivery. Of course, if he can't, that means the exchanges go bankrupt and the price of gold really goes up.
Exactly. I'd also like your thoughts on real estate. You know, we've seen quite a knockback here in recent weeks. It looks like the real estate market, for the most part, has been stuck for about a year or two, treading water. Some of my guests in the industry are talking about this market's going to roll over circa 2008 as the hedge funds and the large institutions start to clear these massive inventories.
I mean, look, in the purchase application, we're released today. The weekly application's down 7%. We're about 5% below the levels we were at a year ago in purchase mortgages. Even though rates are lower than they were a year ago, gasoline prices are a lot lower, so that might free up some consumer spending. And credit standards have been loosened. In fact, now Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are putting U.S. taxpayer guarantees on mortgages with 3% down payments. Yet despite that, you're not seeing a pickup in home buying. So to me, I think it's done. I think if you look at the price appreciation, year over year has been declining, you know, all year. And I think it's not going to be too long before we start to see year over year declines in real estate prices. I think the only thing that's going to save the market temporarily is going to be QE4. But if the Fed can actually, you know, were to raise interest rates, I mean, that would put a nail in the real estate coffin. And I think you'd see another big drop in 2015, maybe as much as 15 or 20% nationally if the Fed actually raises rates.
So then do you see an opportunity for those who just haven't been able to purchase a home over the past few years? I mean, the typical investor has just had difficulty putting together enough money for a down payment despite the low levels that are required for down payments today.
Well, I wouldn't suggest real estate as an investment. So I think investors should be looking elsewhere for returns. But as a individual, as a consumption decision, right, do I want to own a house or do I want to rent, right? That's a decision that somebody could make. And if they decide that owning a house is a better decision for themselves or their family, you know, they can do it. You know, I mean, you know, depending on the market and the type of loan, I think inflation will wipe out a lot of the mortgage, but a lot of it depends on how much money you put down. But, you know, if you really are committed to a community and you've got kids and you want to stay someplace and you're pretty sure that you're not going to move and you want to own a home and you're prepared for all the incidental costs that come along with it, because home ownership is a lot more expensive than renting. But if you're prepared for the financial burden, certainly, you know, a 3.5% down payment isn't that much. If you can get a, you know, I think the rates now on 30-year fixed are in the threes again. They're about maybe 3.75%. And so that's some pretty cheap money for a long period of time. Who knows what the dollar's going to be worth in 30 years? I joke with people, I think 30 years from now, when you send in your final mortgage payment, the number written on the stamp is going to be larger than the number written on your check.
You know, we've had listeners over the years, they said exactly what you just pointed out, where the stamp was worth more than the currency that they'd sent to them from the bank. So maybe we see something like that on the horizon.
I mean, I'm still hyperinflation as the worst case scenario, and hyperinflation still, I think, is something. Look, even Russia doesn't have hyperinflation now, although they have very high inflation, and I think that's certainly headed, you know, in our direction, despite the fact that today the government came out with a CPI number, which was the biggest drop in 6 years, you know, down 0.3, you know, mainly thanks to a drop in gasoline prices. But I don't believe these numbers anyway. I don't think they're very reflective of what's actually happening with consumer prices. So I think that prices are rising much faster than the government claims when they calculate these measures. But I do think that prices are going to rise to such a degree that it's going to be impossible to camouflage them under, you know, a contrived CPI. So I still believe that we're going to experience even official rates of inflation that will be higher than what was experienced in the 1970s. But, you know, whether it turns into hyperinflation is still, you know, open. You know, it depends on what we do, but it's certainly a possibility, and very few people are prepared for that possibility.
Speaking of hyperinflation, you know, we've seen unbelievably high levels here in the equities markets, U.S. equities markets, in the past few years. Some people are comparing it, you know, to the year 1999-2000 market zenith. Do you see anything like that on the horizon? Do you expect the equities markets to roll over, or are they just going to try to keep this train rolling forward?
Well, you know, I think there's a lot of headwinds with the U.S. market. The Fed, you know, helped generate a rally. It was already up before their statement, but, I mean, the statement to me is very dovish, you know, not as dovish as they could have been, but I think it's more dovish than people expected. And so I think that will lead some people to postpone when they think the first rate hike is coming, even though it's not coming at all. But that isn't apparent to most people yet. But I think there's going to be a lot of problems, you know, resistance to the U.S. market, you know, making significant new highs until the Fed comes clean, until we get, you know, more evidence. But, you know, it's a mixed bag, because if we get more evidence that the U.S. economy is weakening, which I think is forthcoming, I think there's been a lot of bad news and people have been ignoring it. But when it finally makes its way into the jobs numbers and the GDP numbers, which is where, you know, that's the only place anybody seems to care about bad news. But when it starts making its way in there, you know, will the markets react to the bad news on a slowing economy by going down because it maybe means that corporate earnings are not going to be there? Or will the market rally because they'll think that the Fed will be there?
Exactly. Well, you know, we've been interviewing right as the Fed statement was announced. And of course, as you say, much more dovish than expected. I mean, they're noting they're going to be patient on the timing of the first interest rate hike since 2006.
The laughable part is they went out of their way to say that the new word patient is equivalent to the old word considerable period. In other words, they're changing the statement, but they're not really changing it. And everybody, you know, like, makes a big deal over these words.
And, you know, they're also watching the labor situation, because unemployment lowest levels, according to their figures, in years. But aren't they really concerned more about what's going on in China, Russia, and the EU? They're concerned of some contagion on both sides.
What has the Fed done in the past? You know, whenever we've had a crisis in Russia or in emerging markets, they've always responded by cutting rates to try to spare the U.S. From any of the pain. Well, how can they do that now? Rates are already at zero, and they've promised to raise them. So what is the Fed going to do to the extent that the Russian problem spills over into a broader emerging market problem or affects the U.S. economy, which it clearly can? In fact, just oil prices being where they are, is it going to affect large segments of the U.S. economy? Because we've built up a pretty big oil industry over the years, based on oil prices being $80 to $100 a barrel. And if oil is $40 a barrel or $50 a barrel, a lot of that investment is going to turn out to a Venmo investment. And a lot of these loans are going to go into default. A lot of the jobs that have been added in the energy sector, which are pretty much the best jobs we've been creating as far as pay, a lot of those jobs are going to go away. And so in and of itself, even though, you know, you have a benefit to the consumer of lower energy, it still could mean that we're going into recession. You know, we had the same benefit in 2008, where oil prices went from 150 down to 30. That was an even bigger decline than we have now, so that was an even bigger boom for the consumer. But it didn't stop the Great Recession. It didn't stop the financial crisis. We had it anyway, you know.
So you might think then we could see something similar. Because we saw that in 2008, as some folks have tried to point to it as a leading indicator, but it really was more of a coincidental indicator. We saw, you know, oil crashing 2008, and it seemed to coincide with the stock market implosion. So maybe not an implosion this time, but at least a serious pause in the advance then, you think?
I just continue to look at the foreign exchange markets, the precious metals markets, for any signs that anybody gets it. You know, that this is all, you know, that the Fed has no idea what they're doing, that they're just bluffing this whole thing, that, you know, we're on the verge of a worse financial crisis in 2008, that the Fed is in this box where it can never end its quantitative easing. So far, they're not giving me that signal. You know, I'm not seeing any meaningful breakout in gold prices higher, a reversal of the gains in the dollar. So right now, it's business as usual, completely complacent. And oblivious to what's going to happen. But I think, you know, when we get a sign that some people are figuring it out, it's going to move quickly. And I think that it's incumbent on investors, savers, to make sure that they have their ducks in a row in advance, that they've got the right portfolio, and tune out all the noise and forget about, you know, the money that people think they're making participating in the bubble, because it's all going to be lost when it bursts. And the people that walk away with the real returns are going to be the ones that never participated and had their correct portfolios all along.
How should investors be looking to participate in the precious metals? Do you like the physical?
Look, we like physical precious metals. We sell at Schiff Gold. We stay away from numismatics because of the notoriously high markups. And I'm trying to get into metals for the metal. I'm not trying to become a collector of rare objects. I mean, you know, numismatics are the same thing as buying, you know, stamps or baseball cards or, you know, works of art. They're collector's items. They're not necessarily monetary inflation hedges. Just because a numismatic is made of gold doesn't necessarily mean it's a gold investment. I mean, I can buy, you know, an antique coffee table. It doesn't, you know, doesn't mean I'm investing in wood, right, just because that's what it's made of. So we go for physical precious metals. But I think for people who have more risk tolerance and want to really hit a home run, these gold stocks, mining companies, gold and silver mining companies, are the cheapest they've ever been. Many of them are priced for bankruptcy. So, you know, if gold just goes to 1,500, which is not a very big move from 1,200, you could see a lot of these stocks double, you know, on, you know, not even a 20% move in the price of gold. So there's a lot of upside there, and we can help you get the right gold stocks. We have a mutual fund that we manage of gold stocks people can buy. Your Pacific Gold Fund. So I think that's a great way for people to go. And, you know, by the way, most people, for all the negative headlines that gold's had all year long, gold's not even down this year. Gold's actually up a couple of percentage points. So it hasn't done that badly. There have been a lot of assets that you could have owned that did much worse than gold. In fact, you know, probably 80% of the world's stock markets, including almost all the major stock markets, underperformed substantially the price of gold in 2014. So, you know, gold hasn't done that bad. I mean, look at Bitcoin. You know, everybody was so excited about Bitcoin, you know, going into the year. Bitcoin prices are now at the low for the year. Last I looked, they're around $317 a coin. They were up over 800 when the year began. So you're talking about a 60% decline, more value than the ruble this year.
As we tried to point out here on the show, take a look at equities. The Dow is up not even, 100% since the year 2000? But if you'd held gold over the same period, you've made 3-4-fold on your investment. There's no comparison there.
You know, benchmark to 2000, because we had a big drop in the Dow, and certainly the NASDAQ. I mean, if you bought the NASDAQ in 2000, you're still down. Right? The NASDAQ was above 5,000, and now it's 4,600. So, you know, you haven't even recouped your investment if you were just long an index fund of NASDAQ stocks. Yet you've still done very well in gold stocks, despite the fact that we've had, you know, a decline over the last few years from the record high. But yet the media, everybody likes to ignore the fact. And, you know, meanwhile, gold continues to protect people from inflation and currency depreciation. I mentioned that gold is only up a little bit this year in U.S. dollars, but you pick another currency. Look at the euro. Look at the Swiss franc, the Japanese yen, the Canadian dollar, the Australian dollar. You've got double-digit returns for gold in those currencies this year. And so gold's been a very good investment. You know, I mean, if you lived in Canada and you bought gold, you're doing better than if you bought the Canadian stock market, the same thing in Australia. Same thing in Germany. You know, if you even though the DAX maybe is up on the year, it hasn't done nearly as well as the price of gold. Most people would be better off, or were better off, buying gold than having bank accounts, government bonds, or stocks in their own country. So we're in a bad year.
I agree with you, and I'd only point out that even if we take the peak of 2000, gold is still such a outperformer, if you will. I mean, it's done so much better than equities. You don't have to go all in on gold, but I mean, you certainly want to have 20 to 30% of your portfolio in the precious metal. That way, if there is one of those rogue waves that hits the markets, just a few 100% increase in gold will offset virtually anything that happens to the rest of your portfolio. Peter Schiff, why don't you tell folks more about the services you provide, please?
Well, we provide brokerage services, asset management services. If people have money they'd like to invest, we help people invest around the world. You know, there are countries that are not economies as badly as the U.S. And I think that in an inflationary environment with 0% interest rates and lots of Fed money printing, you want to be weighted towards equities, just not U.S. equities. So to build a good portfolio, we do that for our clients at Euro Pacific Capital. People can go to the website, europac.net. They can call up a broker at 800-727-7922. For physical precious metals, they can go to Schiff Gold. I am, you know, always talking about the economy. I do a podcast now at schiffradio.com, the Peter Schiff Show. I do usually 3 or 4 different episodes per week. People can listen to them as I post them on my YouTube channel, or you can get them on iTunes, and, you know, different places that have podcasts. So I'm always out there giving information, and if you happen, I don't know if anybody listens from abroad, but my bank, Euro Pacific Bank, is open to non-U.S. citizens, and we have a full array of banking and brokerage services available, including my, you know, my famous gold and silver backed debit card.
Peter Schiff, thanks for making time for us today.
Thanks for having me back on. Bye.
Here is your mining quiz for the day, compliments of GoldSeek. Which company has the largest undeveloped gold reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold. Now, which company has the largest undeveloped copper reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold again. Seabridge has more gold reserves than Kinross, Yamana, and Agnico Eagle. Last year alone, Seabridge added 515 million tons of new inferred resources containing nearly 6 million ounces of gold and more than 6 billion pounds of copper at their giant KSM project in British Columbia, Canada. Now they are drilling at KSM again with multiple rigs in a 25,000-meter program. Find out more by visiting www.seabridgegold.net. Traded on the NYSE, symbol SA, and the TSX, symbol SEA.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
Fabian Calvo runs the NoteHouse.us, which manages about $100 million of distressed real estate each year. He recently penned The Global Economic Reset. It's a pleasure to welcome back Fabian Calvo to the show.
Chris, thanks for having me on. Love GoldSeek.
It's great to have you back, and I'd like to begin, if we could, the dialogue with the coming economic reset. There's always been corruption. There's always been vice. There's always been bad apples in government. What is it that's different this time, though? What is it that you see that's going to take this complex system to that aha tipping point where the chaotic system starts to, you know, roll over the edge of the cliff and everything changes?
Yeah, great point. You know, I'd say, look, if you look at the savings and loan scandal, late 70s, early 80s, people went to jail. Okay, this time around, the banksters on Wall Street are above the law, Chris. Not only are they above the law, but Jamie Dimon and Citigroup and other of these big banks are literally writing the laws of the derivative trading. And so that's, I think, what's changed. I mean, look, in the last year, J.P. Morgan Chase has paid over $60 billion in fines. Really, if you think about it, it's kind of extortion. It's kind of like, okay, well, we're going to let you continue the criminality, but you got to kick us down. It's like straight mob tactic. And, so that's why I think this time is different, Chris, is that the level of, I mean, you're right, there's always been corruption, there's always been, but, you know, in the past, many times, those people went to jail. Well, recently, no one goes to jail. And that's, I think, one of the biggest, because as I said before, you know, one of the big things I think that will lead to the global economic reset, the dollar losing the world reserve currency, is not only a loss of confidence in the U.S. dollar, which is clearly already happening, but also a complete loss of confidence in the U.S. government as an ally, as an economic powerhouse, as having the ability to pay its own debts, and that as well is being called into question.
If we look at the national debt, particularly with regard to unfunded liabilities, it's almost becoming a cliche, I think, in the precious metals crowd. We owe somewhere between 100 trillion with the T and 230 trillion if you talk to Professor Lawrence Kotlikoff, who's been on the show many times. His forecast, well over 200 trillion, 10 to 20 times the total annual GDP, the total economic output of our entire country. Could you imagine, as a home debtor, if you owned that much? I mean, no bank would give you a loan. Nobody would give you a mortgage. We'd be living in our SUVs and our RVs. Tell us what this means on a forward-looking basis.
Well, you know, forward-looking, I think that we have the Fed, still continuing to keep rates at record lows. I think I may have mentioned this last time I was on the program, Chris. You know, the fact that the rates in America has been, you talk about more criminality, let me just throw this one, sprinkle this one in, is that since 2001, 2002, when the rates, because rates have been so low for so long, it's literally robbed the middle class in America of over $9 trillion that it otherwise would have been interest payments they would have received. So you have that component going on, and I think it's disturbing. And let me just also say, you mentioned with respect to the unfunded liabilities, you know, Niall Ferguson, who's a professor at Harvard, actually an historian, has put that number over $220 trillion. It is clearly unsustainable. If this was an economic household, if this was my household, your household, we would have had to have filed bankruptcy long ago. And another point that I was looking at this morning, which is interesting, you know, going back to Russia, we've seen a collapse in the Russian ruble this year, down 50%. But if you look at the fundamentals of the U.S. dollar versus the ruble, the capital ratio for the U.S. Fed is like 1.26. In Russia, it's over 12%. The Russians have been buying gold over 100 tons year after year for some time now, and the Fed proudly proclaims on its website they have literally no gold whatsoever. So, you know, it's definitely an interesting world, that's for sure.
Speaking of no gold whatsoever, you know, recently you may have heard that the Netherlands just repatriated about 100 tons from the Federal Reserve, probably Bank of New York. If the gold is there, physically, the vaults of Fort Knox, how encumbered is it? This is the big question mark. Does this not amount to anything at all? I mean, has the market already discounted what could be going on, the shenanigans behind the scenes there?
Well, you know, that's a great question. You know, I recall when the MF Global and John Corzine's hedge fund went bankrupt, how they had actually in their contracts with their customers a very tiny small print at the bottom that their assets would be allowed to be rehypothecated. Here's another perfect example. John Corzine steals $1 billion of customer money, doesn't go to jail. And so by rehypothecating it, is that they were taking assets and selling those assets multiple times over, to just put it very simply. I believe that's exactly what's happened with the gold in Fort Knox. It's even there, which I don't think it is. I mean, you have members of the U.S. Senate and House that have tried to go in and personally audit it, and it's impossible to do so. So, yeah, I think that poses a very big problem. You said before regarding kind of where does this go from here? And I think, again, because the Fed's zero rate interest policy, they can't raise interest rates or it's going to collapse the U.S. economy. They want to keep inflating the stock in the housing bubble. And I think that's what we're going to see going into 2015. We're going to see them continue to be reckless with the country's finances and with their economic policy.
Well, you know, you talk about inflating the nation's housing bubble, the real estate bubble. What an interesting bubble indeed. 75 years, not a single downtick for 75 years. You could argue the greatest bull market in the history of mankind, period. People turned to the stock market roaring 20s, 1982 through the year 2000, nothing compared with the U.S. real estate market. And as you mentioned, Professor Niall Ferguson at Harvard is a big proponent of the concept that in this society, wherever it is around the world, owning your own land is at the heart, that we all want a little slice of that American dream, if you will. So real estate bubble, why then would they go to all the trouble of blowing another bubble? Well, could it be it happens to be one of the number one employing sectors or segments of the society? Is that what they want? Do they think by blowing another bubble, they're going to pull us out of the mire, Fabian?
You know, I think it's a split decision on that, Chris, because I think some of them definitely do believe that. And the real estate bubble, if you think about it, is very easy to inflate. You just basically give money to people that would otherwise not be able to buy a home, and you have government-sponsored entities basically back those loans. And look, we're looking right now at the millennial generation. I believe it's 18 to 35. They are the largest home-buying demographic in America now, but they can't get – they don't have a down payment. So I think what's obviously happening, it's already started to happen, is that they're going to start giving loans to these people, anyone who could fog up a mirror. So you have a certain group that says, okay, well, that's what we need to do. We need to keep expanding the credit markets in order for the economy to grow. On the other side, I think you have, and this could potentially be a majority, you have literally criminals that are guarding the headhouse. They get this is the end of the of this current business cycle, and they are literally pillaging and robbing as much as they can, and boom and bust cycles are always the perfect place to do that. And so that's what I think is going is a big driver of.
Take a look at the Corzyn situation. You know, MF Global, the focal point for a mob, a group of banksters who are fomenting much of this, because I think you kind of alluded to that, that, you know, we like to have, you know, the Madoffs, the Corzyns. We like to have these people we can point our fingers at and say, see, there's the guy, there's the problem, there, that's it. But is there something deeper at play here?
No question. It's a great point, too, because also they usually go after, like, these low-level managers at banks. When the truth is, I mean, look, you know, we mentioned Jamie Dimon earlier in the interview, and, you know, Jamie Dimon, at minimum, should be imprisoned for what he's done to the U.S. economy. On record, we know, and your audience will know this as well, that, you know, J.P. Morgan's been caught manipulating the precious metals market. You know, in any real country with respect to, you know, where there's real, you know, rule of law. So we have that going on. So yeah, look, there's these low level guys. Corzyn stole $1 billion. The truth is you have the Fed that has stolen through its interest rate policies, has stolen $9 trillion for the American middle class, as they just spoke about a little bit ago. So, you know, it's like what's the scale here? You know, if we're going to go after the big fish, I think the big fish are those that sit on the big banks. And again, I'm talking about the teller at Wells Fargo or the guy who's doing home loans at Bank of America. I'm talking about the upper elite that play by a different set of rules that are not capitalist. I'm a complete free market capitalist. These are crony fascistic capitalists that basically, you know, profiteer from the chaos that they create.
I'd like to know about these six times in history, these six earlier global resets. You say that a seventh global reset is on the horizon. Give folks some background on what we've seen in the past, please.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, it's gone, I believe it's from the Netherlands to the Spanish, to the French. The French had the world reserve currency in the 1700s. You know, then after that, England took over the world reserve currency. They had it, of course, up until Bretton Woods. So that's already happened six times in modern history, Chris. I mean, we can go back and we can look at the Greeks. We can look at the Byzantine Empire. We can look at the Romans. All of them failed because of a reckless central government that completely manipulated and debased the currency. So now we have the U.S. economy, and I think that you see all the indicators of, for example, China now having the largest economy in the world. They've surpassed the United States. They, you know, we've had the head of the IMF openly talk about how they might relocate the head of the IMF or the headquarters of the IMF to Beijing. And so, you know, again, you know, the handwriting is on the wall. The world reserve currency status doesn't last forever. And so this isn't necessarily my opinion. I guess it's my opinion on where it goes from here, but it's historical fact that when you have, and here's the other thing, those other countries that I mentioned before, Chris, what they did economically, many of them, is pales in comparison to what the United States has been doing with derivatives, with everything else that it's done, you know, buying its own debt. I mean, it is unprecedented.
You know, you've also got on record recently regarding the real estate explosion that you expect price to continue to climb. We've seen that ever since at least 2010. You seem to think we could have another 2008-style implosion. And we had the Altays. Anybody, as you say, could fog a mirror, could get a loan. You say they're starting that back up again. Little has changed. There's still an unbelievable amount of toxic debt, mortgage-backed securities, CDOs, and everyone else trying to cover their balance sheet against an implosion. Tell us how you see this unfolding, please.
Yeah, so I mean, you're definitely talking about the all-day loans, or you know, many times they're also referred to as ninja loans, no income, no job or asset. So I think that's a big component in the social engineers, central planners' modus operandi for expanding and, you know, like I said, expanding the credit market to what they believe will fuel and grow the economy. I think we're seeing that in the stock market. I've been saying I think the stock market will surpass 20,000. I think the U.S. real estate market next year will go up 5 to 10% appreciation across the board, but it's going to end very badly. There's just no question about it. The question is, it will end when the rest of the world stops financing America's, and we started to see that with news yesterday that U.S. Treasury holdings from the Chinese are down to a two-year low. So again, the handwriting's on the wall, Chris. You know, your listeners, you know, if they're listening to Gold Seek, they get it. It's going to be time to band down the hatches. But at the same time, as an investor, specifically in real estate, that next leg down, I think, will be one of the greatest buying opportunities for investors that are ready to swoop up on really, really expensive assets.
Folks sitting on the sidelines renting or looking to expand their portfolios may just have that big moment up ahead. Interesting indeed. Well, Fabian Calvo, tell folks more, please, about the notehouse.us.
Yeah, so the notehouse.us is basically my private equity firm, and we invest in about 30 different markets, real estate across the country. And my book on the global economic reset can be found at either fabianforliberty.com or on Amazon. Just Google my or search my name on Amazon, and it'll come right up.
Fabian Calvo, it's always great hearing you. We're going to look forward to hearing more from you.
Chris, thanks for having me on. Love Gold Seek. Keep doing what you're doing. I think you're waking up a lot of people. You got great interviews.
Hey, Chris, this is Robert Ian with ClunkerChange.com. The spending bill passed by the House on December 11th and subsequently passed by the Senate less than a week later repealed a portion of the Dodd-Frank Act for banks. According to a December 11th article on AmericanBanker.com, what banks won was the repeal of a Dodd-Frank Act provision that requires them to push out a portion of their derivatives business into subsidiaries. Big banks fought against its inclusion in 2010 during the financial reform law and have been steadily fighting to repeal it ever since. Citigroup spearheaded the lobbying effort, which has been viewed as a big legislative victory for the bank and its fellow Wall Street colleagues. Since this provision was lumped into a $1+ trillion spending bill, the media has diverted attention that should be focused on this topic into other controversial subjects of that spending bill. Some mainstream blogs and media have barely given it a byline. One major news outlet gave it a one-sentence report by saying, "A controversial provision in the spending bill weakens the Dodd-Frank Act's restrictions on banks that want to trade in the same sorts of risky derivatives that sparked the financial meltdown of 2008 and allows the banks to back their bets with taxpayer-backed insurance." That was it. Not a lot of detail below the headline. Similar reports appear elsewhere online at the top of search results. But the story is much bigger, much more dangerous, and much more imminent to everyone's financial well-being as we approach yet another new year of uncertainty. A discussion this week by Ellen Brown, author of Web of Debt, revisited some statistics we have discussed here before. Namely, that the FDIC Insurance Fund has about $46 billion. That $46 billion is intended to cover roughly $4.5 trillion worth of bank deposits. The fund has only a 1% reserve for the assets it's intended to cover. Basically, you'd get back about a penny on the dollar in a system-wide collapse. If you got 1% of your capital back, at least that's something. But the nightmare is much worse. Derivative exposure by the five largest U.S. banks is estimated at roughly $280 trillion. That's 62 times the amount of deposits held by customers in U.S. banks. You can see we have a bit of a mathematical conundrum. The numbers are stacked against the depositors from the get-go. Mathematically, you lose. Mathematically, we all lose. Dodd-Frank was never a good piece of legislation. It never represented anything close to market forces. It was a hybrid of crony capitalism and crony socialism passed off as reform. But those who have opposed Dodd-Frank and pushed for its removal, like an article on November 3rd by the Heritage Foundation, which concludes by saying that, quote, orderly liquidation of financial firms as provided by Dodd-Frank sounds great. It still allows the FDIC to hold taxpayers responsible for the most worthless assets on a company's books. They conclude by saying, the time-tested bankruptcy system with its legal protections and judicial supervision is a far better system. I beg to differ. Under the Bankruptcy Reform Act of 2005, derivatives counterparties were given a preference over all other creditors and customers of a financial institution, including FDIC-insured depositors. In other words, in a derivatives crisis, the counterparty to the derivatives gets paid ahead of any depositor at a bank. There's $280 trillion of counterparty derivatives exposure in the top U.S. banks versus $4.5 trillion of depositors' money. Do the math. In a derivatives crisis, which many have speculated the current abnormally low oil prices can trigger, how much, if any, of those deposits do you think are going to be left for the depositors, who are essentially unsecured creditors? According to a letter posted online by the CME Group, starting Monday, December 22nd, the COMEX is going to implement price fluctuation limits on gold and silver. Interesting, this is now happening at a point with the most depressed prices of the past 3 years. Placing gold and silver in battlefield bondage. Derivatives that can wipe out depositors' bank accounts. Oil prices that could trigger said derivatives crisis. Prepare for anything. There are so many financial variables on the chessboard. it will be nearly impossible for most people to figure out what happened and why when it does happen. Stay alert, stay focused, and stay tuned. And until next time, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com, reminding you to follow us on Twitter at ConquerChange. Thanks, Chris. Thank you.